It's hour two of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Why do we never get in this hour, Mrs. Future and I will be looking at the topic of artificial intelligence. And to help us understand it more deeply, we will be bringing on Dr. Vivian Ming, named one of the 10 women to watch in tech by Inc. magazine. Her exogenous accomplishments include being a theoretical neuroscientist, entrepreneur, author, co-founded a company called Socos, her fourth company, where she combines machine learning, cognitive neuroscience, and economics to maximize life outcomes in education and the workplace. And previously, she has been a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Redwood Center for Theoretical Neuroscience, pursuing her research in cognitive neuroprosthetics. In her free time, she invented AI systems to help treat her diabetic son, predict manic episodes in bipolar sufferers weeks in advance, and reunited orphan refugees with extended family members. Wow. Well, welcome, Vivian, to the show.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I grew up down in Monterey, so I feel like I'm I'm dialing into home.
Oh, you are. We have a beautiful day today. It's just like almost 100 degrees in this part of the world. So we met you at the UC Berkeley TEDx event. You were having a little discussion afterwards. Mrs. Future here was in a little circle or near the stairs talking to you, and that's how we first connected. I think that AI is something that everyone's hearing about these days, and you had some rather unique perspectives on it, and I wanted to bring that to foreground. For example, you had said that you like the term augmented intelligence as opposed to artificial intelligence. Could you tell us about that distinction?
Yeah, you know, I'm a geek and a science fiction kid, and I appreciate the sort of full breadth of what's possible. So self-driving cars are exciting. And yeah. You know, bots that can talk to you are exciting. Mm-hmm. But in terms of my purpose, of all of the projects I could work on, mm-hmm. I'm interested in projects that take the best of what machines can do and the best of what people can do and create something even better out of their interaction. And in that sense, the coolest self-driving car in the world is still getting me from A to B. Whereas everything ranging, you know, some of the things you talked about, we built a system for Google Glass to help autistic kids read facial expressions. So essentially an augmented reality system in which the ability to read a facial expression is what the AI did. Because it turns out most, though not all, autistic people have a lot of challenges reading facial expressions. So in the little heads-up display, it says the emotion of the person that's being expressed by the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, then we get the best. You still have the amazing capabilities of someone who thinks differently about the world. Hmm. But one of their challenges, which is understanding other people, we can actually leverage the AI to help them with.
It can help them become more socially acceptable and be able to fit in more in situations. Now, I imagine that you've thought about how this form of augmentation could actually improve the education of our kids as well.
I've had a couple of companies in the education space, and there's a long tour of amazing things you can build in the education space. And I have some pretty good stories there.
Yeah, because we have, we have a number of people in this world who have been saying that the technology is not necessarily good for the younger minds because it interferes with natural learning process. But I assume you've thought about that and seen how perhaps it can be. People are seeing that the smartphones are causing problems with the kids these days and makes them distracted, and it seems to be increasing potential suicide risks and that sort of thing. Just wondering, what do you think of that?
So one of my beliefs about augmented intelligence rather than artificial intelligence, and it's a broad one about technology in general, we need a new design philosophy. Mm. And it is that technology should be challenging. Mm. technology right now far too often scratches an itch. It is the equivalent of that rat that hits an experimental lever and stimulates its nucleus accumbens, the part of your brain that is associated with opiate rewards. Mm. And they'll push that lever until they're dead. And it's not a terrible analogy to how we engage with a lot of technology, particularly social media right now. Mm-hmm. And here's an example of a strong prediction that comes out of that. One thing that we know is prophylactic against long-term cognitive decline is actively engaging your brain in behaviors such as navigating the real world. Well, not many people navigate anymore. I don't. I use Google Maps.
Sure.
It is very possible that when a certain wave of people hit their 60s and 70s, that we're going to see a measurable increase in early cognitive decline because we weren't forced to use our brains. Because instead of augmenting our intelligence, it supplemented it. It replaced it. So this is where we could do something more, and we should.
Yeah.
Can we build systems that not only make us better while we're using them, but we're better than where we started when we stop using them?
Yeah.
That's great. Sort of like always being open to learning a new instrument or something.
Well, that's actually learning new instruments, learning new languages. If anyone wants to sell you a brain training game, keep your money. Go learn a new language. I realize the new Google headset will do the translation for you, but it turns out it's a good thing for you either way.
Oh, to let Google do it for you or to learn it on your own? They both benefit you?
Learn it on your own because it changes your brain. It changes who you are. It makes you better. If you don't have to wait on Google Translate, I read today that someone got arrested. I can't remember where, but they were arrested in Palestine, maybe, because Facebook accidentally mistranslated good morning into something that obviously was arrestable.
Oh, dear.
So, oh, no.
When artificial intelligence will fail us, and that's okay.
Yeah.
We don't have to wait for it to be perfect, but we need to understand when it will fail, and we need to understand when we should be doing it for ourselves.
Absolutely. Okay, great. We're going to go to a break right now and come back. And this is our guest, Vivian Ming, with artificial augmentation of intelligence.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Vivian Ming, and some of the key concepts that you've spoken about that I've listened to have been involving maximizing human potential and what you call endogenous motivation, which to me, I guess, would be following your passions, being able to find your passions and having perhaps the augmented intelligence help us with following our passions. Would that be an accurate characterization of your thoughts there?
Yeah. Do you feel in the moment that you're actually making your decisions because it's the right thing for you? Or are you doing it to impress your friends? Are you doing it to get the praise of your parents, to get a bonus? It's not what people think of as machine learning research, but it turns out when you get a data set of hundreds of millions of people and you can deploy artificial intelligence, for lack of a better word, to explore it, what it turns out is the people that follow their own muse, if they will, are always the most successful. And this is even true of salespeople. So all of the bonuses, working to be the guy who sells the most stuff and gets to go on the trip to Hawaii.
Yes.
It turns out it's the person that sells even when they don't have to.
Yeah, because they love to do it, right?
Yeah, when it's just about them. That's the diagnostic. Those are the best, most successful people.
Yes.
Same thing with people that write code. Same thing with little kids, with soldiers. If you're doing it for you, not only does that make you feel good, but it turns out it is predictive of earning more, living longer, being healthier, being more socially connected. That may seem like a wild assertion, but there is this amazing and very large body of research about the things you can change about yourself that are associated with these long-term positive impacts.
So in the long run, so in the long run, our educational system really should be oriented more towards giving us a sense of what our real bliss is, in that sense.
Or superpowers.
Or superpowers, you might say, right?
How do we identify
it? I love superpowers.
Excuse me?
You know, a big part of my life is actually, again, how my big hammer happens to be brains and machine learning. It was what I learned to do as an academic. It's what I've brought into my world as an entrepreneur. Nothing, I think, fundamentally requires it. It's just a set of tools that I happen to know well, and I do a relatively good job of using them. And I do think it's very helpful for addressing questions like, where am I ready to grow? Where is this student ready to make a change, and how is it going to affect their long-term outcomes? One of my favorite economists is a guy at Stanford named Raj Chetty, and he had this fascinating finding that the teachers that make the biggest difference in the long-term outcomes of their students, when those students leave their classes that next year, they actually do a little bit worse. Their grades are a little lower. Their test scores are a little lower. And yet when they grow up, they'll earn more money and they'll have better health outcomes. Huh. So when you think about the way we set up our schools and our companies and most things, we focus very strongly on the incentives, on getting good test scores, on getting promotions. And yet those things, the research says, actually undermine our long-term outcomes.
The exogenous motivations, as you say, are really decreasing.
Way of putting it that explains nothing to nobody, but it is the technical term that I use.
Yes, but it's the normal stimulus that we used for success is actually not really achieving what we want it to. It's not really creating happiness in our potential, as opposed to following your passions and really looking at what you love to do and do more of that. I guess people have a hard time with that because they don't always find they can make a living that way. Like here in Santa Cruz, a lot of people are artists. How do you make a living as an artist?
It's a very reasonable question, although there's this idea of the future of work, and it's become a big field with the emergence of AI and this big debate. Yeah. Will AI take every job, and we'll live in this dystopia where everyone essentially either works for Jeff Bezos or nobody?
Yeah.
Or will AI free us from work and therefore everyone gets to be artists and scientists? And the funny thing, as you say, is artists don't make a living anyways. So if you wanted to be an artist, you could be one today.
Yeah.
You know, it is, I think in some sense, both sides are wrong in this debate. Artificial intelligence not maybe will have an impact. It already is. It will have a profound impact on jobs.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it has to be negative.
Right.
There are some potential bleak futures, but there are some potential amazing futures. And in that sense, it's not about everyone being an artist or everyone being a CEO or everyone going to university. I was very flattered. I had a quote of mine written up on the wall at the Anita Borg Institute's, the Grace Hopper Conference, which just happened. It's this big tech conference just for women, and it's an amazing place. And I wasn't able to be this year, so I was stunned. It was written up there, and it said, "Ambitious men are promising us spaceships and AI and cybernetics. If we gave every little girl the reins to her own potential, we'd already have them." And I believe that this is a general statement. This just isn't about little girls.
Yeah.
This is about so much of the world that's being left behind and doesn't have to be. And it's not about teaching them how to code. It's not about deciding what job they should do. It's about giving them the reins to their own potential.
Yeah.
What does that look like? What do we need to focus on to go that direction?
Have you imagined the ideal school system, for example?
Well, so it turns out my wife is the head of research for the San Francisco school system. And because she and I are incredible geeks, when we are in bed together at night, we talk about our ideal school system.
Oh, there you go.
That's pillow talk for us.
Sure.
Feel free to shed a tear if you think so. And for us, it is student-centered, it is multi-generational, it's collaborative, it's project-based. There has to be substance. People do need to learn math, and they do need to learn technical skills, and they need to learn how to write a good sentence. But it turns out what actually is meaningfully predictive of long-term outcomes is none of that stuff. The vast number of us don't know how to factorize a polynomial, or at least don't remember how to do it from school.
Yeah.
But being able to understand another person's perspective, being able to plan strategically for your future, to have deep endogenous motivation or in a growth mindset. So a lot of my research, even though it's based around machine learning and AI, is about understanding people better.
Yeah, it comes down to that.
And these sorts of things, and there are quite a few of them that exist, are deep qualities about people that are strongly predictive of long-term outcomes and yet are changeable. And our education system should be about building that kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. We have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. We have about 2-3 minutes before our break. Let's just say hello to Richard in Felton. Richard, did you have a question for our guest, Vivian Ming?
Yes, I'm degree systems analyst out of San Jose State, and I love, actually, had a little bit of exposure to DARPA. But what I wanted to ask your host is, how does she think that she's ever going to be able to stop artificial intelligence?
Stop it. I'll let her answer that.
So I think we're talking about this idea of artificial general intelligence. And Ray Kurzweil, in particular, has become famous for introducing this idea of the singularity, where artificial intelligence exceeds our own. Now, Ray thinks that's a wonderful thing. The flip side is, a lot of people, the sort of famous example is that, you know, what if we have this super intelligence and we give it the directive to make paperclips? I don't know why the story is always about paperclips, but apparently people who philosophize about this sort of thing have a fetish for paperclips.
Yeah.
And it goes and it turns everything into paperclips and everyone. How are we going to deal with a world in which there's something that's smarter and more capable than ourselves? So I think there's a few different answers to this, which is, as I said already, there are some genuine threats that AI poses to the world. One is artificial weapon systems. I think that's a legitimate place of concern. But then again, weapons in general are a genuine concern. And I think we need to have bigger, more inclusive discussions about what kind of world we want to live in, and should we be building AI atomic weapons. Another is the job story. And again, there is legitimate concern there.
Yeah, that's a big one. And we really like to talk about that after the next CBS News break. We'll be back right after the news break. Thanks. We're talking to Dr. Vivian Ming. This is KSEO Santa Cruz. Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Dr. Vivian Ming on human potential and artificial intelligence. And one of the things you said in your talk was, that I heard anyway, was that you said that automation in our society will happen from both top to bottom. And talk about cultural disruption. Now, that's going to shift the whole idea of jobs. But to what exactly? Can you give us some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a tough space to prognosticate. And I'm not a futurist. But nonetheless, when we look at this, I think we often think about how we can automate farm work, or we can automate the making of a hamburger. And we think a lot about this sort of stuff, factory workers, drivers.
Yeah, but you're talking about neurosurgeons now too, right?
So we're going to go all the way up. If you really want to understand AI, let me give you just a handful of really quick examples of projects I've worked on.
Okay.
And hopefully a core theme will come through.
Okay.
So for example, we built a system that could recognize individual faces and used it to reunite orphan refugees with extended family members in UN camps, UN refugee camps. Mm-hmm. We built a system for mobile phones that could monitor your movements. It turns out that people's movement patterns were predictive weeks from then about whether they were headed towards a manic episode if they were suffering from bipolar disorder, or a major depressive episode for depression sufferers. We built a system for diabetes that I think you mentioned at the top of the hour,
but
for my son to treat that. So in a sense, one way to think about artificial intelligence, one is it can really do amazing and positive good in the world. And saying no to it means saying no to those sorts of outcomes. And I have trouble with that.
Yeah, sure. No, we did a show last week with the Wi-Fi people at UC San Diego who are looking at how to use AI for predicting the weather patterns of wildfires. So, yeah, it can be very useful.
These are the huge positive human goods. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you think about the commonality across all of these, they represent a complex human judgment. It's not a whole job, but it is, I'm looking at a funny spot on your skin. Is that cancer? Mm. I'm looking at a blood glucose pattern and an activity pattern. Is your blood glucose going to head high or low in the future if you're a diabetes sufferer or movement patterns? Essentially, it's a single complex human judgment that's both profound and simple. But it's profound because most of the work that we do, while it may be complex, it tends to be very rote. So it's not just the guys driving Ubers right now that should be thinking about, should I get a new job, or people driving long-haul trucks, or dermatologists. It's anyone whose core of their job is kind of the same job this week as it was last week. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing risk analysis in financial markets, are you really doing exploratory work, or are you kind of applying the exact same models this week that you were applying last week? If you're a doctor, how differentiated are your diagnoses? If you're a lawyer, when someone walks through the door before you've said anything, can you grab the template will or IP document that you know you're going to use for this person? Yeah. I think, in fact, professional services is a great example. Artificial intelligence will gut the sort of core upper middle class standard of living that the professional services have offered for years.
Mm-hmm. So that's what you mean by being an adaptive creative problem solver, then, is that that's the only option really to pursue if repetitive tasks of any kind are going to be automated.
Exactly. There's a perfect example of this. A bunch of tech companies jointly with the White House,
yeah,
something I personally would have a hard time doing, just announced an initiative to spend $300 million training kids how to code. And in spirit, I get it. Software developers make a lot of money and they solve really interesting problems in the world. The thing is, by the time those kids are out in the world,
the AIs will do all that.
I will be shocked if that kind of coding is still needed.
Yeah, right.
I have some friends, they build AIs that build AIs.
Yeah.
So a very plausible thinking about the future is, and it's a thought about winners and losers, imagine a future 5-10 years from now where you as a designer talk directly to your computer and you say, all right, I want a social network app and it's going to be in blue and it's going to pull people with the same birthday, and you just describe what you want and it gives it to you in 5 minutes, a workable prototype you can deliver into the world.
Wow.
That will be transformative for designers and might explode their industry. But all those people that we trained to be developers will be left wondering, a lot like coal miners are right now, why did they teach me how to do this if they didn't want it?
Well, my question is, what are those things that are human, that only humans can do, that, I mean, I'm happy to offload a whole bunch of stuff to the AIs if it frees me up, but I'm not happy to offload things to the AIs that then create a new catastrophe that I'm not ready for.
And I think those are some of the discussions that we need to have in a different way that we're currently having. I think very fondly of Google and a lot of other companies, and honest way, Google was there for me when I needed them, and I did collaborative research with them. They can do no wrong, but at the same time, it's a company made up of human beings. And whatever I think about them as an organization, they shouldn't be deciding the future of AI without the rest of us, because this is all of our future as well. And nor should Alibaba or Baidu or Facebook or any of them. This should be a pluralistic decision that we make as a society.
Right. Well, it makes me think of the laws of computing that our earlier in the show, one of our callers was talking about. Is that Arthur C. Clarke? Asimov?
Isaac Asimov. With his laws of robotics.
Right.
And those have been debated for a long time. And I think maybe I can now finally do a little justice to that earlier caller, which is about AIs that are smarter than us.
Hmm.
And what I'll say is, that's a legitimate concern, but it's a problem that doesn't actually exist. Mm-hmm. Maybe someday it will, and this is my professional, well-informed, but still opinion, is we have not invented the technology that will give rise to super intelligent AIs. Deep neural networks, which is the core technology behind AIs today, are amazing. But the AlphaGo, that the new system that
Zero
beat the World Go champions, in fact, the even newer system that beat the old system,
yes,
100 games out of 100.
Yeah, we just did a story on that.
It doesn't understand Go.
Yeah. Right. Isn't that interesting? Wow. And you, I think you commented, what would it, AlphaGo was applied to the stock market instead of just a game?
Yeah, one of my professors, this is a long time ago, before we ever were really deep into these discussions, one of my early professors, he built models in which neural networks competed with each other. And then he added in genetics. So you had neural networks and you had game theory and you had genetic algorithm, every cool geeky thing all mixed into one pot. Huh. And one of his main discoveries was there's never a stable state. The AIs will always figure out how, in a sense, how to crash the market and reap benefits from chaos. And in that sense, we really don't want them necessarily in charge of the world in a way that we don't understand.
Now, can I ask a question at this moment?
Yeah.
Which is, who sets the goals for the AIs to aspire to?
So that's a really fascinating question, because the people that set those goals right now are, in broad, informal ways, the leaders of a very small group of companies, and in much more nuanced ways, the people that are actually building them. Except the people that are actually building them don't necessarily know much about the problems that they're working on. By that I mean, they know deep neural networks, this incredibly arcane and complex field. They know how to build them, they know how to train them, they know how to explore that space. But that doesn't mean that they know about the pitfalls of hiring and how you build an AI to hire people in the real world. One of the most famous, continuing to this day, failures of AI is the repeated ways in which face recognition systems fail to recognize black people. Is it because AIs are racist? Is it because the people building them are racist? No, it's because they don't think about a world outside the one that they have mastered. And unfortunate reality of artificial intelligence is it's largely the domain of people that look like me. And it never occurs to them to think, oh, wait a minute, maybe I should pick some black faces in the training set to train up these networks.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what about, do you think your LGBT background has led in certain directions or insights in this issue?
It's fascinating in some ways. For some of my research, I built AIs that could crawl through LinkedIn and Facebook and predict whether people were gay and lesbian. You know, if you're in the closet and on Facebook, you're not in the closet to Mark Zuckerberg. I hate to break it to you. I'm not saying they're doing anything malicious with this. Please don't get me wrong.
They're just looking at the data.
just looking at the data, you can see clear evidence of deep insights about people.
Wow. Interesting stuff.
So my personal history has led me to appreciate that there is a big disconnect between meaningfully solving a problem, having a real long-term impact, and just sort of throwing a potential solution at it.
Fascinating. All right, we're talking to Dr. Vivian Ming about AI, human potential, artificial intelligence, augmented intelligence, and we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Dr. Vivian Ming about artificial intelligence, augmented reality, extended human awareness in various forms. And we were just talking about how Zuckerberg is becoming aware of information about you. Say, if you have leaning towards gay tendencies, they'll know. Now, couldn't the AI, alternatively, as it give you information that would be helpful to you as a young kid learning about yourself, how you could maybe avoid some pain and problems that previous generations have had to deal with?
Well, you know, people may or may not know about me. I went through gender transition about 12 years ago, and the way I look at my life is the last 10 years have been absolutely amazing. The things I've had the chance to do. were wonderful, and it's such a privileged life. Mm. Now, on the other hand, the first, say, 20 years sort of my nominal adult life were pretty miserable. And I don't blame it on anyone other than me. I don't need tears shed over the fact that I was unhappy with myself. But I do think from a human level, from a societal level, mm-hmm. does someone have to go through that to figure out who they are? And I don't mean just about being LGBT or, you know, about anything, but rather if there was some way we could help you find a purpose in the world, or better yet, a way that we could help you build your own instead of just accepting something that the world has given you. If we can short circuit that process and help people reach their potential long before then, I mean, all the human good you do with that, sharing people the pain, but there's also all of the years that I wasn't making a difference. And those are the ones that haunt me.
Hmm. What about AI tutors growing up? Now, the machines have unlimited intelligence for us and our kids. Unlike adults who have their own lives to live, the machines can give the kids almost unlimited attention. Couldn't that be a way in which we could both improve what they learn and also think about the world?
So, yeah, I don't want to oversell the capabilities of AI. Again, thinking hard about these individual judgments and the way that an AI can make them faster, cheaper, and often more accurate than a human can do.
But no emotion chip yet.
Now, in a sense, though, I said I was a sci-fi fan up front.
Yeah.
There is a book out there from the famous novelist Neal Stephenson called The Diamond Age.
Yes.
And it is about this question exactly. What happens if you built this AI who's designed perfectly to make someone the best person they could be? And it is a complex story that has a lot going on.
That was
on,
the book, wasn't it?
It was a book. And
it's an AI book.
You know, it was an inspiration for me in a lot of my education work. Not that I thought he had figured something out deeply, like in a technical sense.
Right.
But to think about that idea, one version of this AI was for a young princess, and another was, in a sense, from a middle-class girl, and the last was for a girl living on the streets, and how this thing changed each of their lives, and in powerful ways. And I've thought a lot about that.
Yeah.
Now, some of this, though, it is clear that technology can help. But what is also clear is the people that are most comfortable with and make the most use of technology are the people that need it the least. So if I invent that AI tutor, it's going to be incredibly valuable to my kids.
Yeah.
But the people that I thought I was going to help, I virtually guarantee it will do nothing for. Not because I invented something bad, but because they have led a life that tells them that it's not worth it, that it's not going to pay off, that technology doesn't change anything. And it's incredibly important for technologists like me to be aware that our work is viewed with skepticism, and that if we don't understand people, then in the end, these are human problems, and they will only ever have human solutions. Mm. AI is just an incredible tool for reaching a human solution. And so you got to know those problem spaces.
Hmm. What about emotional literacy issues? Do you think that those are possible to be tackled by?
Well, one area of my work, it's my last remaining purely academic interest, is called cognitive neuroprosthetics. So this is Borg. It is making cybernetic people. And my personal passion is around things we could do for people that have traumatic brain injury, that have progressive degenerative disorders. But I will freely admit, I'm also interested in what I can do to give slight memory boots to people to improve their emotions.
Sure.
So this is totally fanciful, mm-hmm. but imagine you could open an app on your phone and it had a bunch of slider bars labeled like attention, emotion, friendship, and you could just change those details about yourself. Right now, I need to get this work done. Attention all the way up, emotion down, you know, whatever it is that allows you just
the ideal state to get that done. Yeah.
Yeah. Then tonight I'm going to go watch the new Blade Runner movie. Emotion all the way up, medium attention, rich detailed memory, you know, whatever. Who do you want to be in that moment? Now, there's nobody promising this right now. No one's figured this out. But it is, I think, fair to say, much like the question about artificial general intelligence,
yes,
it may be that in a not too distant future, this fundamentally changes our definition of what it means to be human.
Yeah.
And that should be as scary and exciting as it sounds.
Yes, I totally see that. Now, have you ever thought how AI could be applied to politics?
So I had the interesting privilege of giving a talk, but getting up on a stage immediately after the CTO of Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytics. So this is the company that was part of the data science team behind the Trump victory. And I had a hard time getting on that stage. I had a really hard time. And part of it was regret. About 2 years ago, the former CTO of the Howard Dean campaign and I were thinking about using the technology I've developed, could we use this and help get progressive candidates elected? And in the end, I was uncomfortable with the idea. It felt a little too invasive. Believe me, I knew that we could make a difference. But the idea of shifting people's political beliefs to serve my own, I felt uncomfortable with.
Well, how about
and
where...
That's exactly what happened.
Wow. What about where you use AI, like say, Siri or Echo, where they are able to query people on a one-on-one basis about their beliefs, and then that information, where everyone feels like they're having a personal connection with the candidate and through the AI, and then that collects the information that allows them to make decisions based on real feedback from the...
So, you know, the right way to think about Siri and Google Home and Alexa and all of these things...
Yes. And that's our closest access to AI right now, at least for most people, I think. At least they
is sort of our common everyday experience. And it feels like this thing that you have, as you say, a bit of a personal relationship with.
Yeah.
So here's, I will say as an expert, as an insider, is actually a better way of thinking about it. All of those Alexas are not separate AIs. They're all one AI.
Right.
It's one single intelligence that's talking to everyone and learning from everyone and learning about how we set our lights and learning about what we want to buy, learning about how we move through our rooms and what music we listen to. Again, this should be as scary and as exciting as it sounds, because this is how we think of it technically. A single, you know, there are specific individual AIs in that system, the one that understands your voice, the one that makes predictions about what you want to buy or the music you might want to listen to. But collectively, it is a single robot. Every one of those is like a separate eye and a separate ear, and it's listening not to each of us, but to all of us, and learning about all of us simultaneously. It is an incredibly powerful way of thinking. It's like a swarm intelligence in a way.
Yeah.
And that is amazing if you're Amazon or Google or
if you have access to
Alibaba
the data.
In case of China.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is there an open source AI that we could use instead that you think would be better?
Well, here's the problem. Most of the technology, quite wonderfully, being generated at least in Silicon Valley in a couple of the Chinese big players, is available to the public. They publish publicly. They even publish code and make it open source. But the thing is, to truly make it work in a powerful way, you need the talent that they're able to purchase, but you also need the infrastructure. AI requires incredible, costly infrastructure to make it work in that big way.
That's where the big companies come in. They can do that.
And so part of the reason they publish all that research and they share their discoveries is because they know that no one else can actually replicate it.
Yeah.
Not at the scale that they can do it.
Interesting.
So AI is not a great space. You know, in a sense, there is, in fact, a big foundation called OpenAI. It's for disseminating knowledge, but I don't know if there's ever going to be an OpenAI in the sense that it's an active open source alternative.
Yeah, not yet. Listen, in our last few seconds of the show, is Yizero a book or a website that we can direct people to learn more about you and your work?
Well, you can certainly visit SoCoastLearning.com, where you can learn about our work in AI in the education space.
Okay.
And you're going to have to wait a little bit, but I have two books coming out. Okay. One is called How to Robot Proof Your Kids. And the other is The Tax on Being Different.
Tax on Being Different and Robot Proof Your Kids. Great. Well, good. We wish we had more time, but we must go now. But thank you, Vivian, so much for being on the show. Really appreciate
it. It's been great fun. Thank you.